The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We spoke last class about the Agadic part of the oral tradition, right? That part of the oral tradition that deals more with the ethics and the philosophy. And I told you that the major part, although not necessarily more significant, is the halachic part of the oral tradition. And that necessarily includes the laws, the how-to, as opposed to the agadah, which is the what-for. I want to tell you that as an underlying concept that I'm looking to convey in this class, people very often get too stuck in the detail. There is a certain beauty to the details of any system, but there's a certain danger. And if I could paraphrase that danger, I would suggest that people often get so focused in the nitty-gritty detail that they often forget or lose sight of what those details are ultimately for. Now, that's not to be confused with the opposite problem, which is that people get so involved in the what for and the ideal that they forget that there may well be a beauty and a value to the nitty-gritty detail. And I'm looking to find a balance within those details. Now, I just want to remind you of maybe 2 minutes worth of background that we actually covered in the last class, just to refresh your memory. And that is, we pointed out, first of all, that it doesn't make much sense. And again, I'm sharing you the traditional view and, you know, how I relate to these texts. What you do with it, obviously, is up to you. But it doesn't make much sense to say that there's a written tradition without an oral tradition. We discussed that a little. And there was a value to the fact that the oral tradition was passed on orally. It allowed for a certain relationship with the ideas that flowed out of the text and beyond the text. But at the same time, there was a point in Jewish history where people began to forget the oral tradition because it wasn't written down, and because there was a directed attempt to cause people to forget this, including the killing off of all the teachers who were ordained, who were rabbis. And therefore, at a certain period of time, specifically around 200 CE of the Common Era, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, decided that sometimes within the framework of history, you have to maintain certain standards and continue towards the goal, and therefore make some very difficult decisions. And therefore he chose, along with the Sanhedrin, to write down the oral tradition in its entirety. And that's the sum total of what we call the Mishnah. The word Mishnah comes from the word lishanot, to teach. And the Mishnah ultimately are the teachings in Judaism. The Mishnah contains Agadah, as it does as well contain Halakha. If, for example, there are certain sections of Mishnah which in their entirety are agadic, are philosophical, ethical, for example, ethics of the fathers, which is all agadic Mishnah, but the majority of the Mishnah is in fact halachic. However, and this is what we're going to get to now, it seems to me that ultimately, if these halachot are part of a larger picture, if these details, these laws are part of a larger picture, and if Maimonides, for example, is correct, that this whole system, this whole picture is designed to make me a better human being, with the aim of creating, therefore, a better environment, making the world ultimately a better place, then in fact, somehow, every single detail has to help me towards that goal. And if I could pick the problem with studying Mishnah, with studying Gemara, which I'm going to get to a little later, the Talmud, it's that we lose sight of the value of those details. So that's what I want to do today. And I have really a couple of different aims. One is to give you that sense that there is much to be gleaned, that when I study a Mishnah, when I study a halachic detail, that I have to walk away as well, not just with the knowledge of the detail, but with how and what it means to me as a person, how it makes me even a better person, because then I develop a relationship with that halachic detail. But second of all, I want to give you a familiarity, sort of an introduction to what this body of work, which is Mishnah and ultimately Talmud, is, because this is the backbone of the traditional Jewish study system.
And perhaps even we can touch upon just vaguely a little bit of a how-to. Okay? So with that in mind, now, what I want you to do is I want to break into Chavruta. We won't have much time, but I want to break into a Chavruta and I want to study a Mishnah. Now, I have to mention to you two details about this Mishnah. First of all, look at this page. If you look on the English on the right, you'll see it says Mishnah. All right? And you'll see that there's a sort of a bolder print in the English. Right? A paragraph. That paragraph is the Mishnah. Following it, okay, is what's called the Gemara. Now, Gemara, which is an Aramaic word similar to Mishnah, to teach, to study, is much later. And if the Mishnah, for example, and I mentioned this last class, if the Mishnah was edited, compiled, more or less completed by the year 230 CE, the Gemara, which is often referred to as the Talmud, from the word lilmod, to teach, the Gemara was completed around about the year 500 CE. There were actually two Gemaras, two Talmuds. One was completed in Israel. It's actually called the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, but it wasn't really edited in Jerusalem. There were no Jews allowed in Jerusalem at the time. It's called the Yerushalmi Talmud out of respect for Jerusalem. And that was finished, edited, compiled by Rav Yochanan around about the year 300, 330 CE, Common Era, right? In other words, after the year zero. The Babylonian Talmud was finished around the year 500, 510 CE. We follow the Babylonian Talmud. There was a certain period of time when the Gaonim determined that there was a tremendous danger in having two Talmuds, two commentaries on the Mishnah. There was a danger that there would develop then two Judaisms, those who followed the Jerusalem Talmud, those who followed the Babylonian Talmud. Since the overwhelming majority by the 5th century found themselves in Babylon, and since the Babylonian Talmud actually took 130 years longer to edit, and therefore was much more accurate with less mistakes, they'd had more time to compile it, to make sure they weren't forgetting anything. So these rabbis in the later period, up until around the 10th century, ruled that we should follow the Babylonian Talmud. And they set about ensuring that every community everywhere would indeed follow the Babylonian Talmud. I have to mention to you one very important point. Maimonides points out that the most important thing about this work that we're studying now is that this is the last period of time when there was a work that was completely accepted by the entire Jewish people. In other words, the entire Jewish people, at least those who found themselves within tradition, followed the Talmud. Now that's not so with later works, for example. We'll maybe get to this when we discuss the Code of Jewish Law, but the Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jewish communities, both of which find themselves well within the realm of tradition, don't all follow Maimonides. Some do, some don't. You can have a debate on halacha, and Rashi will say X, and the Ramban Maimonides will say Y, and some will rule like Rashi, and some will rule like the Ramban, and it's perfectly legitimate to rule according to either, and how one arrives at a system of ruling is a difficult question, which we won't get to. But the Talmud was accepted by the Jewish people en masse, largely due to the efforts of these Gaonim, these scholars in the later period from about the 6th till about the 9th, 10th centuries, to develop a relationship with Jewish tradition. To rule halachically within Jewish tradition has to take into account what the Talmud says and has to be able to show that his particular or her particular ruling is within the framework of Talmud. That's what makes this so important, bar none. Lastly, I would add that what you're looking at when you look at the whole Talmud is the sum total of the oral tradition. In other words, if you studied the entire Mishnah, and you were able to understand all the nuances of the Mishnah, because as I mentioned last class, Rabbi Huda Nasi, by force, wrote very cryptic comments which were designed to remind us of much larger issues, because ultimately they wanted to have as little in writing as possible. The Talmud does the same thing, and writes down as little as possible, leaving whole areas which were assumed to be known already. And the idea was that the text would remind you of those larger issues. Right? For example, if I would give a class on belief in God, and then I would give a class on God's involvement in the world, and then I would give a class on whether or not God chose to reveal the purpose of putting us in this world, I could then, after three of those classes, in a later discussion, say, of course, we're accepting those three ideas, and really write on the blackboard, God, God's involvement, divinity of the Torah. And you will remember those three classes. And that's exactly what we're looking at in the Talmud. Now just a couple more quick words on how this works and what it is. There's six sections of Mishnah, which are divided obviously by topics. Right? Zra'im, which deals with all the laws of the land of Israel. How to tithe and how to give truma, the offerings to the priest, and the laws of the land, how to set aside sections for the poor, what you could eat from the land and what you couldn't. And because it ultimately involved produce, the first section was called brachot, which deals with blessings, let's say. The second section is called mo'ed, which deals with the holidays. Mo'ed means time, it's a holiday. And these are all the laws of Passover and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Shabbat and Sukkot, the Feast of the Tabernacles, and all of those types of laws. Then I have a section called Nashim, women, which are all the laws of interpersonal relationships with women, marriage, divorce, etc. Then I have a section known as Nezikin, damages, torts. These are all the laws of the relationship between a human being and a human being's fellow in terms of property suits and damages and payments and legalities. Then I have a section called, right, Kadshim, which literally means from the word Kadosh, holies, which are the laws of, or the sections of law that apply to the temple, the sacrifices in the temple, and the worship in the temple, and the different obligations on the priests, etc. And lastly, I have a section called Taharot, which means purities. Taharot. If anybody, by the way, really wants to have this sort of down, you can ask me later, I'll write it out for you. Purposely not doing it now because of the limitations of time, but this is very easy. By the way, I want to mention as an aside that if you want to see a good synopsis of how this breakdown works, there's a set of Mishnah, which is translated into English, called the Blackman Mishnayot, and they've got a little list in the front. Philip Blackman, I believe his name was. There's another set of Mishnah which is published by Art Scroll, also in English, with an excellent introduction to how the Mishnah works in the first volume, also well worth the read. The Talmud then has, the Gemara, different tractates. And each tractate deals with a specific section of Mishnah. For example, if I have a section of Mishnah called Moed, which are the holidays, and one of the tractates of Mishnah is called Shabbat. In fact, I should add one more detail. The Mishnah was that body of work of edited oral, compiled oral tradition, which was put down into writing, which was completed around the year 200 in Israel by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince. Okay? Rabbi Judah the Prince, who was the greatest scholar of his day. Somehow, there's much debate as to how he did it. Did he take words that were already sort of common and just write them down? Did he have students write them down? Did he take writings of different students, collect them and compile them? Are these his own words? There's much debate about this. But suffice it to say that he somehow edited and compiled the Mishnah, and that was completed around the year 200. The Talmud, or as I'm referring to the Talmud, some refer to the Talmud to include the Mishnah and the Gemara. But the Gemara, which is the Aramaic word for Mishnah really to some extent, right? The Gemara was completed around the year 500 CE in Babylon. Okay? You look confused. What are you missing?
Yeah. Gemara. So what is that? Is that different from the oral tradition
that was written? No. The Gemara again is the addition to the Mishnah. In other words, if I have a...
Oh,
there was a lot of stuff that didn't get written down. Remember I said that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi wrote down comments cryptically. He was looking to write down as little as he could. About three, that's okay. If you don't follow something, then stop me because I don't, otherwise, you know, I'm building blocks. Yes, that's fine. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi around the year 200 was trying to write comments in as cryptic a fashion as he could. But a couple hundred years later, the rabbis realized they were still forgetting too much. And the danger of forgetting things was too great, so they wrote down more. And this has been a process which has been continuing through our exile. So the Gemara was edited and compiled together by two men, Ravina, R-A-V-I-N-A, and Rav Ashi, A-S-H-I, in Babylon. Now, like I said, there was a Jerusalem, there was a Babylonian, but we'll talk right now about the Babylonian, which is what we're studying. Let me just show you how the page works, just briefly. First of all, in English, so first I have a section of Mishnah, and this is, by the way, the Sansino translation. There are now different translations that are out. If you want to get a translation with much more detail, many more commentaries that are translated into English, if you really want to study in depth, which, by the way, just as an aside, I don't suggest for most of you at the stage you're at, but if you should get to it, there's a set of Talmud, it's not complete yet, but in volumes, called the Schattenstein Talmud. It's published by Art Scroll, which is a magnificent translation, not only of the Mishnah and the Gemara, but also of many later commentaries.
and gives you much more of a picture of the flavor of study. So you look at the Mishnah, and that's the first section, and then the next section is the Gemara, which we're not going to get to. Okay? Now, look at the Hebrew, because I want you at least to see how the page works. When you see over here, look up at me, you see there's like a central, like a sort of a big bold, right? That's because this is the beginning of a tractate. Generally, at the beginning of a tractate, you'll find that the first word is highlighted like this. But at the beginning of a chapter, you wouldn't find it that way. And you will find, in fact, that this is the Mishnah, right? And then you'll see over here two bold letters, Gimel and a Mem, if you read Hebrew. You'll see there are two black bold letters in the middle over here. And that Gimel Mem stands for Gemara. And that's exactly where the Gemara begins and the Mishnah has ended in the Hebrew. There are other ways to note within a chapter where a Mishnah is, but we'll leave them for now. If you look at the page, just to give you a sense, because this is after all one half of a page of Talmud, of Mishnah and Gemara, you'll see on the inner side that there's a commentary. And you'll notice, by the way, that the letters are a little different. It's a different type of Hebrew writing. It's called Rashi script. So if you don't recognize how to read it, don't worry about it. But this is called Rashi. Rashi, you have heard about a little bit when we studied Chumash, right? And he is probably the greatest commentary on all of these works, 1040 to 1105, right? On the right side of the Mishnah Gemara text, on the outer column of a page, right? And here it's on the left, but if the page was on this side, it would be on the right. It's always on the outside. And there's a philosophical idea there, but we'll leave it for now. This is called Tosafot. Now, Tosafot literally means, from the word Lahusif, additions. These were the additional comments of the grandchildren of Rashi on their grandfather's comments. And it's very often they're looking at a Talmudic discussion and they disagree with their grandfather. Or in some cases great-grandfather, some cases great-great-grandfather. And in some cases it was students of the grandchildren of Rashi, and in some cases it was colleagues of the grandchildren of Rashi, but they're all bunched together in this thing, this commentary we call Tosfot. And the Tosfot, right, is the other major commentary on the page. And that's much more complex. Rashi, you get a sense, still had this sort of desire to write down almost as little as he could. So he wrote also very short, cryptic comments. He was also interested in analyzing the text from a contextual perspective. Whereas very often, Tosfot get much, much more into it. So on a comment in Rashi, which is one line, you might find a Tosfot, which is the whole column. Then you find on the page, I'm just showing you what else is on the page, there's a magnificent thing called the Ein Mishpat Ner Mitzvah, which is up here by the, you see the letter Bet, right? And you'll see that next to it there's a little Aleph and a little Bet and a little Gimel. And you can, these are like footnotes. In other words, you'll find an Aleph in the page. For example, look on the page and you will see right on the first line of Mishnah. Okay, if I'm going too fast, you'll stop me, right? Agreed? You see the first line of Mishnah, there's a little Aleph above one of the words in the Hebrew, okay? So what is that little Aleph? That little Aleph leads me up to the Ein Mishpat. And you'll see that at the Ein Mishmat, there's a little Aleph. And the first Aleph shows me that this particular line of Mishnah, right, is to be found in Maimon, Maimonides, Perek Aleph Mihilchot Kriyat Shema, the first chapter of the laws of saying the Shema, right? And then it'll give me where in the code of Jewish law it appears, etc. In other words, this Ein Mishpat is a little index to tell me how to find the halacha. Okay, I've read a Mishnah. But this Mishnah was concluded and edited, you know, 1700 years ago. What do we do today? How do I know what the halakha says today? So I can actually look up on the page where to find the actual halakha in Maimonides and even in the code of Jewish law. And from there I can begin to ascertain and glean what the halakha wants of me from this Mishnah. And this is Mishnah and Talmud and all the way through. And then there are other little things which we'll leave aside. You'll notice on the inside of the column, you'll see, look up here, you see there's the text of the Mishnah Gemara here. And then next to it is the Rashi, you see that? And in between is like a column with a few little letters in there. You see that? Now that in between, right, are the quotes from the Torah. For example, the top one, it says Devarim Vav, Deuteronomy, number 6. So that there's a verse quoted here. And I can figure out where to find that verse. Okay? In traditional study, if I'm in yeshiva and we're learning, one of the things that I train my students to do is that whenever you see a verse, you have to look up the verse. Because the Mishnah or the Gemara will only quote one piece of a verse. Where does the verse appear? What's the context of the verse? What's it talking about? Especially when you get to like prophets and later writings. So you want to know what's going on. And then you'll find on the outside column, another sort of an index, which is called the Masoret HaShas, the tradition of the Shishas Darim, of the six sections of the Mishnah. And this outside column will tell me where else in the Mishnah or the Talmud something is quoted. Okay, this is over here in the outside column. Like, you'll see there's like little comments in between the Hebrew page and the English page. You see that? Over here? Over here? And that again will tell me, for example, I can see that there's a Talmudic discussion. You'll see the little stars in the Hebrew. Do you see the little stars occasionally? See that? Those little stars tell me I'm looking at a quote. And if I look to the side, I can see where the quote is from. One quote is from another Talmudic discussion in the Tractate of Taanit, which deals with the laws of fast. One quote here is from a different work of Midrash. And this can be very important because when I'm reading the Gemara, which is from a later period, I may find I'm actually reading a section which is quoted from a Mishnah somewhere else, so that it's a much earlier period. So don't worry if the details that I just shared with you are sort of becoming a blur, because I just wanted to give you a sense of how the page works. I think it's a wonderful thing that a person can see a page of Talmud, and that to me is the first stage of developing a connection with this work. Even if you don't know exactly how to do it in Hebrew, you don't know what each detail, you don't remember which side is which side, but you should be able to see something like this. And this is really the only Jewish work which looks like this. It's not like other Jewish books that they're all written and you have to look at the cover and the title. When I see a page like this, if I saw this folded in half like this, I would instantly know that this is a page of Talmud. Because there is no other work that has this format. Now, yes?
When you say Talmud, it's Mishnah. I mean, it's Gemara, right?
No, let's make this clear now, okay? Because these words are interchangeable. The Talmud, there was a time that the Talmud referred only to the Gemara. People today very often use the Talmud to refer to the Mishnah and the Gemara, the whole sum total. And in fact, the Mishnah and the Gemara and all of her commentaries. Right? Like if I would say, let's study Talmud, I would begin studying the Mishnah, and then study the Gemara on that Mishnah. Right? However, very often when a person is having a discussion about the Mishnah as opposed to the Talmud, then he means the Talmud or the Gemara. So I'll try to say Mishnah and Gemara, right? If I mention the word Talmud and you're not sure which it refers to, you'll stop me. I do this on purpose only because I don't want to choose to refer to use the word Talmud to refer to one or the other, because you'll get used to that, and you may later hear someone mentioning the word Talmud, and they could mean either one. Okay? Okay. So that's enough of a technical introduction. Yeah?
Just a question. In the Talmud that has a quote from the
Torah. Right.
If this were a section on Shabbat, would it have the quotes where everywhere in the Torah it talked about Shabbat?
It would have any quote that appeared on that page. Because in the Tractate of Shabbat, you will find all the quotes that deal with Shabbat. But they won't necessarily be in an order that you can look through here without going through some, you know, 100 plus pages of Talmud to find all the quotes. Right. In fact, by the way, that's one of the things Maimonides did. We're going to get to Maimonides tomorrow, I think, our next class. One of his gifts was that he organized it so that now you have a way of looking up all the places that the Torah speaks about Shabbat. But this is specific to what's being discussed on this page, right? And you'll see what I mean in a minute. Okay. Now having done this, now I want to have some fun. Because one of the challenges, and I have to tell you that our goal in this class is completely different from our goals in the previous class, right? I think it's realistic for a person to walk out of Israelite and to say, if someone wants to, I'd like to get more into Bible study. And therefore, the class that we had on Bible, on Chumash, it is a good beginning introduction so that a person can then take a Chumash and begin to play around with it. I think it's legitimate for a person to walk out of Israelite and say, I'd like to begin studying the Haftarot or the prophetic writings. I'd like to see what Isaiah has to say. I don't think that it's realistic that someone in this class would, or for that matter should, at the stage, and again, I don't know all of you personally, so I'm making a blanket assumption, which I will grant you is a terrible thing to do, but just a gut feeling from, you know, the type of student that comes to Israelite, to begin to study Gemara. You know, it'd be like going to university and having some magnificent teacher teach you, I don't know, a Pythagorean theorem or the beauty of geometry. And you walk out of one class, your introduction to geometry, and you're all excited and you start to go look up books on calculus. So notwithstanding that you could get a lot out of calculus, and you could figure out large parts of calculus without having studied any algebra. It would be difficult, but you could do it. But of course, unless you've studied physics and you studied certain basic systems of math, you're just not going to get out of calculus what you could. The same is true here. To study Gemara before
you have a working knowledge of Chumash and of Navi, right, of Bible and of prophets, is something which precludes from you getting to the root of the beauty. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't study Mishnah or Gemara until you've covered the entire Bible. Because then most of the students that we have today in Yeshivot would never study any Mishnah. Because most of them have not been through the entire Bible. But at least that you get a certain sense, a working sense of how Chumash works, how Navi works, how the Bible works, how the prophets work, etc. I would say there are certain exceptions to this within the world of Mishnah, and I will give you a few examples at the end of class. Okay? That's just, right? But I do think that a Jew walking around who wants to sort of have a relationship with their Jewish heritage should know what the Mishnah is, what the Gemara is, what the Talmud is, what it contains, what its purpose is, where to find it, you know, what's involved. Right? Okay, so understand that these are different goals. Now, having said this, I want to show you how beautiful a Mishnah can be. And I purposely chose the first Mishnah in the entire Talmud. This is the beginning of the tractate known as Brachot. And what I want to do is I want to briefly study together this first Mishnah, bearing in mind that within our limitations of time, you know, we're not going to get as deeply into it as I'd like to, but at least to give you a taste, and you can keep this page if you want to, that's up to you, right? And here's what I want you to do. I want you to read from the beginning of the Mishnah until the end of the Mishnah. Alright? So again, my suggestion. Alright? Now you're a chavruta. Now you're learning. And this is real yeshiva learning now. And first, the same thing as we did in Chumash. First get a reading, then go back and try to learn it. And see how it works. Okay? Alright, go ahead. So essentially the law that's being discussed is
when to say the Shema.
When to say the Shema at night. When do I say the Shema prayer at night? Okay. That's the question. And then there are three responses, three opinions, right? First I have Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer says, I can say the Shema, right, during the first part of the evening. The first, we'll call it the third of an evening. By the way, just an aside, it's not set up quite the same way as is our system of time. Rather, the daylight and the nighttime are two separate units. And essentially, an hour of daylight is a 12th of daylight. So that in the summer, an hour is more time, and in the winter, an hour is less time. Because the system of Jewish tradition was very much involved with what were my opportunities during the day, and what were my opportunities at night. For example, if I have the Seder, I don't have the Seder during the day on Passover. I have the Seder at night. So it doesn't matter to me how much day there is. What matters to me is how much night I have. And if the middle of the night is an important point to the Seder, so I have to know when that middle of the night is based on how long the night is. Okay? So when we say that the night is divided into three parts, it doesn't mean that it's 4 hours. It means that a night in the winter is much longer than 4 hours, and a night in the summer is much shorter. Okay? This is called in Hebrew, sha'ot zmaniot. Timely hours. Alright. So Rabbi Eliezer comes along and says that I say Shema, right, until the end of the first unit of time. And then the Torah scholars, the Chachamim, they say that I say it until the middle of the night. And then Rav Gamliel comes along and says that I say it until dawn. Okay? Those are the basic details. I've left out one very important detail. What's the very important detail I've left out? When do I begin saying the Shema? When do I begin saying the Shema at night? About this, there's no debate. I begin saying the Shema at night from the time that the priests come in to eat their truma. Okay? Hang on 1 second. And that's my basic framework. And then there's a little story. Rabbi Gamliel, you know, points out, in fact, that really when the Chachamim, when the Torah sages, by the way, according to whom we follow, according to whom we rule halachically, when they said till the middle of the night, they really meant all night. Really, they agreed that you could say it until dawn. The reason that they suggest that you must do it by midnight is because if you leave it till dawn, you might not get to it. Right? Which means, the phrase in the Bible, kedei l'archik et adam min avira, to push you further away from the possibility of transgression. Okay. So now what we've done is we've read through the Mishnah, we've synopsized the Mishnah. By the way, we also broke the Mishnah down. I've got a question, I've got a response, and I've got the commentary on that response. Alright? The response has three possibilities. Okay. Now, let's have some fun. What bothers you? There is one major question
that begs itself as soon as you read a couple of lines of this Mishnah. Which is what? Why is this? I mean, this is the first Mishnah in the Talmud. This is how I begin Talmud. Maybe I should rephrase that. This is how I begin Talmud. I mean, I'm all excited, and I get to study Talmud, and I've never been there before, and I open up my first Mishnah, and what's my first Mishnah about? Well, what would I expect my first Mishnah to be about? God. I mean, is there a God? And even if you want to say, well, no one would open up the Talmud if they didn't already have, if they hadn't already considered whether or not there was a God. So at least I'd expect it to say, you know, given that there's a God, there's a Torah. But you might argue, no, nobody would open up the Talmud without at least considering the fact that there was a Torah. So then you say, okay, I'm going to begin with a mitzvah. So the mitzvah of Shema, very strange. But okay, let's assume that I even begin with the mitzvah of saying Shema. You know, there's a very important detail in learning Mishnah, Gemara, in learning the Talmud, which you will come into contact with anytime you go to visit a yeshiva. And that's the way they learn. There's a sort of a sing-song, right? You won't find the average yeshiva student reading, Me'imatzai karen et shema be'arvin. No, that's not how they read it. They, oh, me'imatzai karen et shema be'arvin. Right? And this is like, you know, some of you I noticed it's like Sunday morning. It's difficult. So that's how a yeshiva student gets himself into it. And it's a very valuable message. If you come into class and you're a teacher, right? If I'm a teacher and I'm tired, I'm always tired, right? You come into class and say, good morning, I'd like to share with you something on the oral tradition, right? So, oh, great class. I don't think so, right? So you say, get out! Oral tradition! What is the oral tradition? Well, then nobody can stay asleep. That's what they're doing. Wait a second. I don't understand. So I want you to understand that whenever we have a question in the Gemara, that's what you got to do. Okay, so now let's see. From when do I read the Shema? When do I read the Shema? Who says I have to read the Shema? And what is reading the Shema based? What is reading the Shema? What's the Shema? I mean, I get to the Talmud. The Shema means to listen, right? Hear, O Israel. When do I read the hear? What is that? What does that mean? And even if I knew what the Shema was, how could you not know what the Shema is? But okay. So what do you, when do I, from when? And you come in at night, you read, what, do you, what is Shema? And by the way, why do I begin with the question of saying the Shema at night? Why don't I begin with the Shema that I say in the morning? Traditionally, I say the Shema in the morning as well as the night. So why don't I start with that? And let's have some more fun. So now the Talmud says, okay, from when do I begin saying the Shema at night? As if this is the most important detail in a Jew's mind when he begins studying Talmud. You know, last night you wanted to say the Shema. And you wanted to reflect a relationship with God. But you weren't sure what time to say it in the evening. What is the answer to that question? What kind of an answer would you expect? Let's say for some reason details are important. What kind of an answer would you expect? When do I begin to say the Shema at night? From? New? Sunset. Give me another possibility. But what comes after sunset, which is the time for, when the stars come out, nightfall. What do I get here? From the time that the priests did cometh in, from their ritual bath to eat of the tithing. Now what is that? When do I say the Shema in the morning? When the swallow flies far in the sky as the eagle. What does that mean? As a matter of fact, if you look at the Talmud, the Talmud is going to say, what does this mean when the stars come out? Well, so why doesn't the Mishnah say that? What kind of backwards system is this? And it's interesting, by the way, nobody debates this. Everybody agrees with this. And I'll go you, by the way, one further. Who is Rabbi Huda Nasi talking to here? I mean, he's editing this in the second century. There is no temple. It's quite clear that the concept of priesthood is disappearing because I have priests, but I have no temple. And there is, by the way, a whole section that deals with the priesthood and the tithing, etc. So that one wonders what the necessity of doing this here. And then I get to a debate. They all agree that this is the time that you say Shema from. And then they debate till when you can say the Shema. Now that's very interesting. First of all, because I would have expected the Mishnah to tell me, as soon as it's nightfall, however they define nightfall, one should say the Shema. What do you mean, until when can you say it? That shouldn't be the issue.
The issue should be, when do I say it? And what is the debate? Well, I can say it the first part of the night. I could say it till the middle of the night. I could say, it's almost as though you're picturing these rabbis, who moments ago you had so much respect for and desire to learn from, and now you picture them sitting around the table. No, 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 no. Let's give them till midnight. No, I think we can go till dawn. Well, really, dawn means midnight. Well, I think the first... Well, you know, what is that? And by the way, there's a principle in exegesis and study. Whenever there's a debate, and this is valuable not only for the study of Talmud, but for any study. If I'm studying Chumash, if I'm studying the Bible, and I see that Rashi says something, and the Ramban, Nachmanides disagrees, do you know what my most important question is? My most important question. I mean, first I have to see what they're talking about, and I have to study the verse, and I have to figure out, you know, what is Rashi saying? Okay. And then I have to figure out, what is the Ramban saying? What's my most important question? I mean, there's a debate here. And this, by the way, is the difference between reading and learning. Between a university study experience and a living Torah journey. Do you know what my most important question is? What are they arguing about? What are they arguing about? And by the way, and you see this all the time, I mean, the Ramban was no idiot. He knew what Rashi said. He quotes him very often. So why doesn't the Ramban say what Rashi says? He must have a reason for disagreeing with Rashi. Even more important, because Rashi came first, why doesn't Rashi choose to say what the Ramban says? Nachmanides will very often say, well, Rashi says X, and I disagree, and therefore I say Y. What do you think? Rashi didn't think of what the Ramban said? He was a genius. He didn't consider that possibility ever. I mean, you could theorize that once in a while Rashi maybe didn't think of it. He was human. But for the most part, he must have considered the possibility. He must have been aware of the difficulty that Ramban had with what he said. So why does Rashi stick to what he says? What are they really arguing about? What's the debate? And very often the search for the response to that quest will become crucial in developing a relationship with Torah. Same is true here. What are they arguing about? What really is their debate about? Now, we may not get to this now, but that's a very important question. And then let's go on. What is this story doing here? You don't often find stories in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is a halachic system. What is that story? Even more fascinating, what's the story that the Mishnah discusses? The Mishnah tells me that Rabban Gamliel has chosen the most lenient approach, right? According to Rabban Gamliel, you can say the Shema at night and fulfill your obligation to say Shema at night up until dawn. So his sons come home, right, from a mishteh, which the commentaries tell us is a wedding feast. They went to a wedding. How could it be the sons of Rabban Gamliel didn't say the Shema yet? It must be that they were involved in another mitzvah. Whether this is a tradition we have or a comment, it doesn't matter to me. So they're involved in another mitzvah. What's the mitzvah the commentary says? And by the way, the word mishteh generally means a wedding feast. In other places in the Mishnah, but what is that mitzvah? Giving joy to a bride and a groom. It's very interesting. The mitzvah that we're focused on in the story is not that they were putting tefillin on. It's not that they were, you know, eating their matzah. It's a mitzvah of giving joy to another human being. Tremendous idea. So they come home, and they suddenly realize, whew, we didn't say the Shema. Right? Okay, I'll buy that. Tremendous, right? You come home, it's 2 a.m. You've just been dancing all night. You just want to get into bed. Oh my goodness, we've not said the Shema. Wonderful. And they look at their non-existent watches, right? And they realize that it's past midnight. It's past Chatzot. So they say, what shall we do? So they say, let's go ask our father. To which I have one word response. Duh! I mean, they must know this debate, because they're the kids of Rabban Gamliel. And they must know what their father says, because this must have been a famous debate. So what are they asking their father for? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, it's like Bill Clinton's daughter going to Bill and saying, do you think I should vote Democrat or Republican? What is that? And then even more interesting is Rabban Gamliel's response. Rabban Gamliel's response isn't, well, I think you can say it till dawn. No. He says, well, you know, the Torah sages said you could only say it till midnight. But really, when they said midnight, they meant you could say it till dawn. He's not saying my opinion is. He's saying their opinion really allows for this. Which, of course, begs another comment, which is that maybe he's not even arguing with the sages. He's merely expressing the fact. In fact, maybe the story comes to tell me that his original opinion in the Mishnah is not differing with the sages, But he's merely pointing out that ultimately you can say it until dawn. Whereas the sages are saying you should say it before midnight. So what does that mean? Does that mean that now there's no value whatsoever to the sage's opinion because really you can say it till dawn? Or does it mean there's no value to Rabbi Gamliel's opinion because really you should say it till midnight? What is that? What's that story? So now let's have some fun. And I want to point out to you a few details which are part of a general introduction to the study of Mishnah. And I want to tell you, by the way, there's a certain type of music, which is the music of Jews learning Torah. And I can't define it. But it's different from any other music that you will ever hear. That I can tell you as a sense. And you walk into a yeshiva. And by the way, not only a yeshiva. You can walk into a home, a Jewish home, very often. A synagogue. A study session. It doesn't matter. The dining room over here. And people are discussing an issue of Jewish learning. And they get so involved. And I remember when I was in yeshiva, so there were certain periods, it was like waves. Like if you would walk at 12 o'clock in the morning, on a Monday morning, right, midday, which was an hour before lunch in the yeshiva I studied with, it was like a roar that would come out of the Beit Midrash. I mean, you could hear the roar from all the way outside. Because there are 600-700 guys, and they were all arguing with each other. They're all studying this. What do you mean? Why does it start with this? I don't understand. Wait a second. Doesn't Rabbi Gamliel say in another place? No, that's not Rabbi Gamliel. That's Rabbi Lezer. What are you talking about? Wait, let's look at Rashi. I don't want to look at Rashi. I want to first understand. Why are you talking about? And you listen to this noise. So you bring somebody, you know, you think, I want to show you the beauty of Torah study. Come see yeshiva. It's wonderful. So you don't want to interfere with the yeshiva, right? So you go, maybe you stand outside, you look at the window, whatever. What do you see? You see 800 guys arguing with each other. And people get so into it. I remember one particular example. I was studying with my chavruta, and we were debating some issue. And the guys sitting in front of us, so they were listening to what we were saying. One of them says, no, you're wrong, because it doesn't work that way. And I said, no, I think you're wrong. And the other guy said, no, he's right. And before you know it, there were like 8 of us debating this topic, right? And I remember I had a chavruta who was really, he would really get into this. Like he would have a little spill come out of his mouth, and he'd really into it, right? Body language, and he'd jump up and say, what are you talking about? No, this can't be. Good luck. No, yeah, what are you talking about, right? And then somebody said, no, it's a lonacha, what are you talking about? That doesn't work that way. If you say like the Rambam, then fine. But we don't say like the Rambam. Look in Shabbat. In Shabbat, it says something different. That's not what Bracha said. This person's looking at the window and saying, what's wrong with these people? Like, what are they arguing about? It's my life. It's my oxygen. It's me debating with the nurse whether or not I took my medication this morning. It's debating whether or not, you know, we should I don't know, put our mother in a nursing home or bring her home to stay. Debating whether or not I want my children to go to this school. It's life. And Jews developed a relationship with Torah that made it alive. And you know something? When you get to this level of study, it shows how much you love a text, that it moves you to that extent. So that's first of all. I want to also point out to you something very interesting. Because what Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did here, in starting with the detail, and forgetting to give me the entire principle, the philosophy, the ethic, is not a unique case. It's interesting to note that this happens in every single tractate in the Talmud. For example, if you look in the beginning of the tractate of Shabbat. So what would I expect to find? What is Shabbat? What is the value and the beauty of Shabbat? Where in the Torah does it tell me that I should have an experience on Shabbat and celebrate Shabbat? No. Hotzel, Shvayin, Shein, Arba. There are two ways of carrying, and there are really four. And if you walk from a private domain into a public domain, what do you mean private? Well, walk and carry. Who? What's Shabbat? If I look in the tractate known as Chulin, which deals with the laws of Kashrut, so again, I expect to see what is kashrut and what's the beauty and has it helped me become a better person? Has it involved my relationship with God? What is kashrut? What are the central verses? No. If a butcher drops a knife and you pick it up and there's a crack in the knife, can you slaughter the animal? Is the slaughter? Who slaughter? What? Galah? Same idea. Every tractate. And I'll tell you what I think Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was saying. I think he was saying that to develop a relationship with Torah, ultimately, you have to look at the details of Torah. Because sometimes you can get too stuck on the majestic picture. And there's a beauty to the majestic picture.
But if you really want the Torah to come alive, if you really want to get a sense of what it is that allowed Jews, and by the way, who is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi talking to here? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the greatest Torah scholar of his generation, bar none. He was a brilliant individual. And he was dealing with a crisis that the entire Jewish people was facing, really at the dawn of exile. His generation was the first generation in which one could suggest that it sank in, that they weren't going home in a hurry. They weren't rebuilding the temple tomorrow. Rome wasn't disappearing. Christianity was just rising on the horizon. It had been now 130 years since the temple was destroyed. The Bar Kokhba rebellion was long since over 70 years earlier, and there was no help in sight. Difficult persecutions. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was one of the first great scholars who said, we can't fight Rome, we have to join them. And he became very close, actually, with the Roman Emperor. That doesn't mean he gave up his traditional ideals, but he felt this wasn't going away. How is the Jewish people, without a temple, going to survive in exile? They're not going to survive with the platitudes. And they're not going to survive with the ideals. Love thy neighbor as thyself is not enough. How do I love my neighbor as myself? What percentage do I give to charity? The details of Torah, the intricate tapestry and framework of Jewish life is in the details of the mitzvot, said Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. And it is the relationship with these details. It is bringing these little small issues to life that will allow the Jewish people to survive in exile. And I would venture to say that he was right. Because if you look back over 2,000 years of Jewish exile, what kept the Jews Jewish in the ghetto? It wasn't the Shema. The Shema is very powerful. And it's a principle. And it's important. But it's not difficult for me to relate to a fellow Jew, fellow human being, the beauty of Shema. It was getting up in the morning to say the Shema. Every morning. At a certain time. With all the other Jews. It wasn't the beauty of Shabbat sitting and singing. It was the fact that a certain period of time before Shabbat, everyone was lighting Shabbat candles. And that no one would go out into the field and no one would separate the chaff and everything else that was involved with Shabbat. And it's very interesting, by the way, when you look around us today, there's no shortage of ideals and platitudes. You won't find a Jew today who doesn't think that love thy neighbor as thyself is magnificent. And you won't find a Jew today who doesn't see a certain beauty in the Shema if they will but read it. And it doesn't seem to be doing the trick. Because thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Jews are disappearing. And Jewish heritage has become something to pull out of the old dusty photo album once in a while. To tell the children about as we put the Hanukkah menorah next to the Christmas tree. And so there is something to what Rebbe is saying. And I don't have the time to do this topic justice, but it's worth pointing this out. With that in mind, I would still suggest that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi understood that this was an introduction to the entire Talmud, and that he is beginning the task of putting pen to paper and giving the recipe to the Jewish people of how they will survive, of what Judaism means. So with that in mind, let's take a look. It's interesting, first of all, that the first mitzvah here is the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. What does Kriyat Shema represent? Kriya is to read, the reading of Shema. What does the Shema represent? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Very interesting. The rabbis discuss what the idea is behind the Shema. It's very interesting, you know. What would I have expected it to say? I mean, ultimately, that's a statement of Jewish faith. Is that a fair perception? Statement of Jewish faith. And it's a statement of Jewish faith which has become linked inextricably with Jews being willing to sacrifice everything for their Jewish identity. Jews were burned at the crosses in Spain and went to their deaths in the camps with the Shema on their lips. That I believe that there's a God. That I believe that God is one God. That I believe that God is Elokeinu, is our God. That I have a relationship with that God. Which makes it all the more strange that the first word of that statement is not believe that there's a God. It's not see God.
It's listen. Hear, O Israel. There's a God. What does that mean? What is it that the essence of my faith begins from listening? There's a beautiful comment by the original Lubavitcher Rebbe, if I'm not mistaken. He says, what's the difference between listening and hearing? Between listening and seeing? That first question would challenge you. I can choose what to look at. I can look at you. I can look over there. It's the easiest thing in the world for me to see you or to choose not to see you. But it's very difficult to choose not to hear something. Right? Ultimately, everything around me affects what I hear. And the relationship with God, with Hashem, that the Jew is trying to develop is one of sound. Not that God is something that I see if I look, but that ultimately God is everywhere. There's nothing that I have to do to allow God in, but to allow God in. That it's all around me. And that's the relationship I'm trying to develop. It's interesting also that the second word of the statement is Yisrael. I haven't even gotten to the word Hashem. Who am I supposed to listen to first in order to develop my relationship with God? Yisrael, my fellow human being, my fellow Jew. Because if I can't hear Israel, then how am I supposed to hear God? If I can't develop a relationship with my fellow human being, how can I develop a relationship with God? The abstract. So there's tremendous, tremendous ideology in the Shema. And it's interesting that the Talmud will discuss from whence do I know that I have an obligation, that there is an actual mitzvah, an opportunity to say the Shema every day, more than once a day, morning and evening. And the Talmud discusses where this is from. But the Talmud definitely concludes that I have an obligation to say the Shema in the morning when I rise and in the evening when I go to sleep. So why does the Mishnah begin with the Shema of the night? Now hear well. Because this is a principle of Judaism which Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi chose to put on the first page of Talmud. What does the day represent? And what does the night represent? Night represents faith. Day represents redemption. There's a beautiful verse. La'agid baboker from the Psalms. La'agid baboker chazdecha. To say in the morning thy praise. Ve'emunatcha balelot. And the faith of you in the night. Day is when I can see everything. It's easy to have faith in the day. Because it's apparent. It represents the realization that God is everywhere. Because I can see it. Night is not so easy. At night, when you can't see, when it looks as though God isn't even there, that's when you have to have faith. It's interesting, by the way, that we celebrate our month as a people based on the moon. One of the ideas that's mentioned, I think it's the Maharal of Prague, Lowy of Prague, 16th century or 17th century, is that the moon waxes and wanes. But no matter how much you think the moon has disappeared, it will always return. And the Maharal says this is actually like the Jewish people. No matter how difficult things are in the night, ultimately there will be a dawn. That's why we begin with the Shema of night. Because Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was speaking to a Jewish population that was entering the longest night of our history. Specifically in that night, in that darkness, when it looks as though you can't even see where God is coming from. This, by the way, relates to the opinion of the sages. Of midnight, of the middle of the night. When it's darkest. This is, by the way, why we eat the Afikoman, the Paschal sacrifice, specifically by midnight, in the middle of the night. When the darkness stretches out equally in either end. Because specifically in the night, which represents my faith in Jewish continuity, which represents my belief that ultimately God is there even though I can't see God, but I have but to hear God, that's when I say Shema. And it's interesting, by the way, that the Jewish day begins at night. It's interesting that God created the world beginning with night. Vayihi erev, vayihi voker. And there was night and there was day. It's interesting that the verse of saying the Shema is b'shachbecha uvekumecha, when you lie down and when you get up. Because lying down represents my passivity before God, acceptance that God is there. Bikumecha, to rise up, that represents the dawn, that represents redemption, that represents my partnership in bringing God back into the world. And everything that's going on in the modern state of Israel, with the Jewish army, and people coming home. And that's all, interestingly enough, in the beginning of this Mishnah. Give you another idea. What is this weird time for the beginning of night? You would think that the last thing that should be mentioned in this Mishnah is priests and their tithes. Because they don't have a temple anymore. Which is probably exactly the reason that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi chose to include it. And he found a way to include the temple even in the first Mishnah, which is so back round the elbow. And perhaps the message that he's giving the Jewish people is, don't think that this isn't a part of our lives. That this idea of a temple and a service and the Jewish people in their homeland and an independence, that it's gone forever. It'll come back. We don't know how long it'll be. We're just at the beginning of night now. And it may well be a long time before we can realize that goal of coming home. But it's there. The concept of a priest, the concept of truma, is a very important concept. Truma ultimately is the first part of my produce that I give over to a priest. Before I enjoy the bounty of my work, I give to someone else. I represent and reflect and recognize that there's a higher ideal. Litrom means to donate, to give. That's what a Jew is supposed to be about, giving. And that's also part of why this is here. Because my relationship with the Shema is very much bound up with my relationship with my fellow human being. And lastly, that's very much why the story of Rabbi Gamliel is here. Look at this powerful message. What is the first relationship that the Talmud clues me into? The first instance of Torah study written down includes within it the relationship between father and son, parent and child. Tremendous idea. As if to say that that's ultimately the relationship I'm looking to develop with God. More than that, what a beautiful concept that Rabbi Gamliel's sons come to ask him and to learn from him and with him Torah. And that's also included in the first Mishnah. Because that's very much a part of the relationship that we're trying to develop. And lastly, I don't think it's accidental that the first Mishnah in the Talmud makes a point of giving over to me an ethical message. Kedei laharchik et ha'adam min avera. To distance me from sin. So that according to Rabbi Gamliel, and Rabbi Gamliel, by the way, was the Nasi, he was the head of the entire Sanhedrin. We don't rule like him if the Chachamim, if the majority of scholars disagree with him, even though he's the president of the entire Sanhedrin Rabbinic Council. But what's going on here? First of all, I see that Rabbi Gamliel respects the opinion of Torah sages, of the Chachamim, which is a very important lesson, one that we have a lot to learn from today. But second of all, I see, what's the whole message here? What are Chachamim trying to do, these Torah scholars? What essence of human nature are they reflecting on? That if I give a Jew an opportunity to say the Shema until dawn, he'll wait until dawn. Don't wait till dawn. Even though technically speaking, you can fulfill your relationship with God in the night, that idea of faith, as long as it's night. Don't wait. Because ultimately, if you wait, you may miss the opportunity. And because there's a value to attempting to avoid the potential pitfalls in life, then that's a very powerful message. And it's a message that every human being can apply to him or herself. How many opportunities do we have, and do we grab onto them? Do we seize them? Or do we wait, assuming that we have more time? And by the way, it's true for our development as Jews, our relationship with Judaism, relationship with Hashem, whatever it means for each of us. And I wouldn't presume to stand here and to even venture to say what that relationship should be. But whatever relationship a person chooses to undertake, don't allow it to go stale in the fridge.
Don't let it die. You know, sometimes a relationship or a beautiful idea or a potential to develop in a relationship with God, with yourself, with those around you, with your children, sometimes it dies because you actively kill it. I'm not interested in this. It doesn't do it for me. Much more tragic is the person who has that relationship, but just never does anything about it. And so eventually it dies a quiet, passive death. That's also the challenge of this Mishnah. What Rabbi Yehuda Anasi is saying here is we're in the night, but don't wait till dawn. Now! The priest, at the end of his day, having become ritually pure, has the opportunity to fulfill a mitzvah. How do I know that when I see priests eating their truma that it's automatically nightfall? Maybe they waited around. Maybe it's 10 minutes after nightfall. There's an assumption that the meaning of a priest, the meaning of someone who's on somehow a higher level who serves God, is that when they have the opportunity to fulfill a mitzvah, they run to do it. It doesn't sit, it doesn't wait. And on that, everybody agrees. That's definitely the ideal. And that's the challenge of the first Mishnah of Brachot. It's very interesting. The tractate of Brachot is all about blessing. It's all about recognition, appreciating what we have, finding ways to express that. And it begins with how I choose to activate that desire, which is the Shema. We could speak about this Mishnah, I promise you, for a week. The commentaries on this Mishnah are endless. And these are perhaps just a few short ideas. And there is, of course, the importance of studying when exactly I say Shema. If I'm on a plane and I wake up and I'm not sure, can I say the Shema or not? Because that detail is important. It allows me within a certain framework to develop that relationship with God and not just to do it randomly and blindly as I choose. But at the same time, if I walk away from that study of detail and I don't inculcate the ethic behind the detail, then again, I'm missing something very important and very valuable. And this Mishnah clearly reflects that if one will but look for it. So this has been a brief journey into the world of Mishnah and a brief introduction. There's obviously much, 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 much more to say. And if anybody chooses to get more into this, I would suggest to you, even though those Mishnayot are largely, in fact, entirely Midrashic, right, Agadic, are the Mishnayot of Pirkei Avot, of Ethics of the Fathers, which is a magnificent system, the sum total of Jewish ethics. I would also point out to you on the back shelf there on the right, you'll see like a green 3-volume set. It's called Ethics of the Fathers, or Ethics from Sinai. It's by Bunim, Irving Bunim, and it is a magnificent set. It's one of the best commentaries I've ever seen to Pirkei Avot. And if you read his introduction and just the first Mishnah, you'll fall so in love with it that you'll decide to continue it. It's a magnificent commentary. He brings a lot of stories and anecdotes in order to understand the Mishnah in general and Pirkei Avot in particular.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.